Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Karen Cadwell, an internationally recognized leader in the field of breastfeeding and human lactation. So as you guessed it, we'll be discussing and answering your questions about breastfeeding. You can reach us with your questions and comments in Anchorage. You can call 550-8433. That's during the next hour, our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Cadwell, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you.
Dr. Cadwell is the Executive Director of Healthy Children's Center for Breastfeeding in Massachusetts. She's an internationally recognized leader in the field of breastfeeding, as I mentioned earlier, and she is one of the initiators of the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, an effort to make sure that hospitals and birthing centers are following at least 10 steps that seem to be successful in helping breastfeeding get accomplished in the United States. She's an author of numerous books and articles on breastfeeding, and this is the first time we've had a chance to talk with her. I got her name from my head nurse, Jessica Daniels, who attended a certification course on breastfeeding about a year and a half ago, I believe, in Anchorage, and she mentioned that Dr. Cadwell was an excellent speaker and uses a lot of very good evidence-based information, so we thought we'd invite her on, and I want to say again, thanks for joining us, Karen.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's just start with some more basics. That's my typical way of doing things. Why should mothers, let's talk about just the United States at this time. I know you're involved internationally, but what about mothers in the United States? What's the reason for talking about the importance of breastfeeding?
Well, you know, it is interesting that you mentioned that it's probably different in the United States than it is in other parts of the world. Breastfeeding and starting solid foods at the right time can make a difference in about 20% child survival in the rest of the world. And for many years, people only thought about breastfeeding in terms of child survival. It was noted starting in about 1930 that babies in tropical climates especially had a higher mortality rate if they weren't breastfed and breastfed exclusively. But those articles published about this research didn't make a lot of impression on especially physicians and healthcare workers in more temperate climates like the U.S. And it wasn't really until the connection between our big problem, which is chronic diseases, long-term illnesses, and breastfeeding, that the United States really wakened up to the idea that breastfeeding would have advantages. So in the U.S., the big advantages are around diabetes. Probably 20% of diabetes is related to not breastfeeding or not breastfeeding with great enough intensity. And that's probably the largest expense in terms of our healthcare dollars. Probably 1 out of 8 or 10 healthcare dollars goes to diabetes. Other issues like rheumatoid arthritis, you know, which is a long-term chronic problem, are diminished with breastfeeding. So there's a lot of interest in, you know, how we can reduce our healthcare costs with breastfeeding. And even some acute problems like ear infections are diminished by breastfeeding and by increasing the intensity of breastfeeding.
Are there, we've talked about, it sounds like to a large degree, listening to what you just said, that the benefits to infants, and I certainly want to come back to that. What about from the mother's side? Are there specific benefits to moms to breastfeed?
Well, you know, I think that when we're talking about maternal benefits, the first thing that comes to mind is reduction in the incidence of breast cancer. A major problem in the United States, and we have a very high rate of breast cancer. But what we can clearly see is that breast cancer, to a large extent, has to do with our reproductive habits. We have very few children, and we breastfeed them not at all or for short periods of time. And when you look at international studies, what you can see is that our reproductive habits, and especially our duration of breastfeeding, have a lot to do with our numbers of breast cancer in the U.S. Ovarian cancer, research indicates that for every month of breastfeeding, the risk of ovarian cancer decreases by 2% compared to women who have the same number of babies who don't breastfeed.
Let me remind our listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is an internationally recognized leader in the field of breastfeeding and human lactation, Dr. Karen Cadwell. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. The issue about diabetes being related to breastfeeding is something I'd like to flesh out a little bit better. What is known about the mechanism? Is it simply a fact that those babies who don't breastfeed have a tendency to be more overweight and develop more type 2 diabetes, or is there more to it?
Well, that's certainly one. We do know that babies who are breastfed are much less likely to be overweight and have a chance of getting type 2 diabetes, especially early on, now that we recognize that type 2 diabetes is not adult onset, that it actually can happen to very young children and toddlers. So that could be part of it. But when we think about type 1 diabetes, it's pretty clear that giving formula within the first 9 days of life is related to, this is the closest relationship to the development of type 1 diabetes between the ages of 9 and 15. And it's really fascinating that the problem is that the baby can't break down, especially cow's milk protein, and into its subunits. And one of the subunits is a 16-link chain of proteins that actually is identical to the chain in the Isles of Langerhans that produces insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So for some babies, they have an autoimmune response when they're confronted with this subunit that they can't break down.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can see is the antibodies that the baby's mounted actually breaking down their own pancreatic cells.
So I'm going to rephrase that, because I think this is a difficult concept but an important one, is that probably some infants genetically predisposed will make an antibody, a protein against a component of milk protein that is a normal response by the host, the baby, to that milk, but that will cross-react and begin to attack certain cells in the pancreas that make insulin and might lead in an increase in risk of type 1 diabetes in babies who are fed milk early in the first several days of life. Am I saying that story correctly?
Yeah, fed cow's milk. And when they looked at all of the formulas for sale in the United States, all of them contained this chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the chances are pretty high, if you have a family history of diabetes, that you're exposing the baby to, you know, potential reaction. But it is a normal reaction to have a response to foreign proteins.
Yeah. In fact, our immune system is very good at making response to almost all the food proteins that we eat. It's just that most of the time they don't cross-react with other tissues, and that's the important issue here.
And in Scandinavia, where the familial risk of type 1 diabetes is very high, they've actually been able to take these antibodies out of newly diagnosed children and put them in electron microscopes with the cells from the pancreas and film these antibodies destroying these cells in the pancreas.
Can all women breastfeed successfully?
I don't think so. I guess I have a jaded approach to it, because the women I see here at the Center for Breastfeeding often have seen many other people before they come here, and their situations are really complex.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we were all meant to be able to breastfeed, certainly, But what we know from time immemorial is that there have always been women who either didn't want to, didn't choose to, or couldn't breastfeed. And so there have been animal milks used as far back as we can remember, and wet nurses have been used as far back as we have history. So we can't say it's a product of modern times that we find women who can't breastfeed.
Do you have any feeling about why some women have trouble? I would agree with you. It seems in my experience as a pediatrician, some women who really, really make a great effort are not all that successful. Often they may make small amounts of milk, but it's like they just never make significant enough to support the baby. Do you have any ideas of why that might be?
Well, I think that's one of the things that the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative really tries to focus on. I think the newer research that we have about prolactin receptor sites and the fact that they really need to be turned on in the first hour or two after a baby's born, and that the baby suckling within those first couple of hours changes these receptor sites from being progesterone sites to prolactin sites. And we probably have a very, very brief window of breast stimulation to assure an adequate milk supply. Once those sites have, these sites on the milk cells have involuted, it's very, very difficult to get them to change back. And I think that's one of the reasons that we see with hospitals that institute the 10 steps to successful breastfeeding that they have many more mothers breastfeeding at 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. So let's explain this a little bit more. Hormones have receptors on many cells, and that's how they begin to transduce the information that they need to cause something to happen within an organ. And the organ has cells that have receptors for these messenger things that we're calling hormones. And so you're saying breast tissue at birth has a limited time that it may respond to prolactin, which is what helps that milk production to occur. And if it's not stimulated, and it's very common for us in medicine to recognize that if we don't use these receptors of any kind of hormone, they may decrease in number. But there's some evidence that these prolactin receptors will lose their sensitivity if not used early in life. So that may explain why some women have more difficulty with breastfeeding.
Right, and then they struggle against not having enough of the functioning tissue to produce the milk.
Okay.
So it doesn't really matter what size her breast is. It doesn't matter, how much she wants to breastfeed. If she doesn't get early and frequent stimulation as these receptor sites switch over from the pregnancy hormone of progesterone, which made colostrum, to the prolactin receptor sites, which will make mature milk.
Mm-hmm.
There's just involution.
Understanding the way medicine works and what we find is, my first thought is there are going to be women who, for genetic reasons, probably do not have normal numbers of receptors, or they have abnormal receptors that don't recognize prolactin well, and so they're always going to have trouble. That's one question that comes to my mind. And the other is this issue of galactagogues, which are things that may help increase breast milk production, and understanding what you've just told me, most of those are being used to try to increase prolactin. But if there's not the receptor there, it doesn't bode well for success.
Yeah, and that's kind of the mistake. I mean, when researchers have looked at whether or not certain substances increase prolactin, they find, there's plenty in her blood, but it doesn't increase the amount of milk because the receptor sites aren't functioning.
Hmm. Very interesting. I was not aware of that, so thanks for pointing that out. It helps us understand why some women may have some problems early on. And it really, the issue or the information you want to promote is this: getting that breastfeeding established or efforts made very early in the first several hours is perhaps critical for this.
Yeah, and some of the work that I've been doing in Egypt and other parts of the world involves what baby behavior is like in the first hour, hour and a half after birth. And my colleague at Karolinska in Sweden, Anne-Marie Widstrom, published her research last fall about the 9 distinct stages that babies go through on their way to the breast. And as we've looked at babies in all conditions, I mean, in some parts of Egypt, general anesthesia, epidurals, you know, all kinds of conditions, cesareans, it doesn't make any difference. Babies will go through these nine stages on their way to the breast if they're not interrupted. So that's another problem that happens, you know, frequently, is that the baby is given to the mother, she holds the baby, and then the baby's taken away and washed and buffed and measured and bathed and all of those kinds of things, and then put back. And what you've done is lost some of the time the baby needs to get to the breast. And they're going to fall asleep by the time they're an hour or an hour and a half old. All babies mm-hmm. fall asleep at that point. Mm-hmm. And if they're away from their mother, they can't accomplish these nine stages. And as a result, they fall asleep without a good feeding and without stimulating the mother's breast.
And so a baby who is slightly premature or for one reason depressed at birth may have more difficulty establishing that breastfeeding.
That's right. That's right. And you have to just work harder later on to make sure that that it works. But Jane Morton's done some wonderful research at Stanford showing that mothers of premature babies who did hand expression mm-hmm. In those early minutes and hours after the baby was born had much more milk, twice as much milk, as mothers who either waited or used a breast pump.
Well, that's that's an interesting comment, because I had, in the course of looking into some issues about breastfeeding myself, Stanford University has a breastfeeding site that mentions that exact thing, that they have found in studies that women who hand express get more milk. And I said that to a couple of lactation consultants, and the comment was they have noticed that there are women who prefer a hand expression versus pump, electric pumps or mechanical pumps of some sort. But, you know, it seems like in our culture, we got to spend some money on something.
That's right.
we got these two hands there that don't cost anything extra. And it turns out they may be better.
Right.
And so I'm glad to hear you say that. But I also have mothers look me cross-eyed when I mention that to them, too. One, because I'm a man, but I do refer them to that website. And they were talking particularly about premature infants, where they've had some success
right.
in mothers getting the milk out that way.
Right. I have to tell you about a prenatal class I was teaching that I said, and you know, the wonderful thing about breastfeeding is that you don't have to buy anything.
Right.
And one of the mothers burst into tears. And I said, oh, my gosh, what did I say? And she said, I like to buy things. So,
yep. Have to keep
one of the things about having a baby is that, you know, like, you want to get everything ready. And I think getting a breast pump is, you know, is on everybody's list.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection. We're talking about breastfeeding, and we're answering. We got one of the world's leading experts here. So if you've got questions about breastfeeding, the benefits, or how to get it going, or problems that you've had you'd like to ask questions about, please take the time to give us a call. My guest is Dr. Karen Cadwell. We're on Line One. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Why do you think that more women don't breastfeed or stop earlier than is generally recommended in the U.S. in particular?
Well, I think women may not choose breastfeeding because it's just not part of what their family does. You know, people say, well, I was fed formula and we all turned out okay. You know, so there's a, you know, family decision that's made about how babies are fed, and it feels really comfortable in those families.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of breastfeeding long enough, it's a complex question about why women in the United States don't breastfeed longer. We know that women who go back to work, for example, initiate breastfeeding at the same rate as women who stay at home. So going back to work doesn't affect the choice to breastfeed. But we also know that the month that women go back to work is the month that they generally stop breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
Managing the work life, the home life, having a balance there is tough whether you're breastfeeding or not. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of women think, well, something's got to go. I'm just not managing. So mm-hmm. breastfeeding's the thing that's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Another part is not really understanding babies and baby behavior. And so when the breastfeeding mother observes normal baby behavior, she may think that the baby's behaving that way because he doesn't have enough milk.
Mm-hmm.
And in some interesting studies in England, they asked breastfeeding mothers why their baby cried. And 201, the breastfeeding mother said, you know, it's my milk, it's not good enough, it's not rich enough, I don't have enough. But when they asked the mothers who were feeding their babies formula why they cried, none of them blamed themselves. Mm-hmm. They said, he's crabby, he's just like mm-hmm. his dad, you know, he's just an unhappy soul, he doesn't like being alone, he's spoiled, you know, all kinds of baby mm-hmm. reasons. So the breastfeeding mother seems to be more sensitive to thinking that it's about her and it's about her milk.
Yeah, and they can tell how much formula they're getting from a baby's getting from a bottle. It's always a question, particularly with that first time mother, is she making enough milk? Is the reason? And so they always seem to blame themselves that they don't have enough milk.
Right.
Even when you show them a good weight gain, we kind of use about an ounce a day on the average as an indicator of good weight gain. Is that a reasonable way to convince parent mothers that they've got plenty?
You know, there's some block there. I know that mothers wish that they had like Pyrex lines on their breasts the way we do on measuring cups, you know, so you would know exactly how much the baby had gotten. But I've had mothers whose babies were gaining 1, 2, 3 ounces a day and still had doubts about their milk supply.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of it is the weight gain, but some of it is just, you know, the unsettled baby.
Mm-hmm.
Or the maternal expectation that the baby's going to sleep for 4 hours or sleep through the night at 2 weeks or, you know, something else that's pretty unrealistic for newborn babies but is an maybe a family expectation. Because grandmothers, and I'm a grandmother, grandmothers don't actually remember our babies all that well. So, you know, when I say, oh, my baby slept through the night at a month, or my mother tells me I slept through the night at a week, you know, it leads to all kinds of family myths that you have to live up to.
Yeah, it's a very important point worth mentioning again, that the best evidence is our memories are not very reliable. We have a tendency, our memories when in good studies really come about and convince ourselves what we want to think is right, not what actually happened. And that sounds like it's a good example of that. And our mind is pretty good at fooling us, it turns out. How do you discuss breastfeeding with a woman who doesn't want to breastfeed? I struggle with this, just like I struggle with trying to talk about the importance of immunizations with someone who doesn't want to immunize.
I ask people what attracts them to formula feeding or what attracts them to breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And what they feel uncomfortable about. And, you know, oftentimes I'll say to somebody, so what attracts you to breastfeeding and what makes you feel uncomfortable about breastfeeding? And they'll tell me all these wonderful things about breastfeeding, and they don't want to do it because their boyfriend thinks mm-hmm. it's disgusting, their mother doesn't want them to do it, they're afraid they wouldn't have enough milk, their sister tried it and her nipple fell off.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of fear about it. And then, you know, when I can get to the underlying sort of repulsion or fear, sometimes it's something you can do something about. I mean, with some people, they say it's like having sex with a baby. It's disgusting. Mm-hmm. You can't change somebody's mind about feelings that are that strong. But when people have misconceptions like, my sister had a problem, so I'll have the same problem, you can say, well, you know, we know a lot. We have the resources to help you. And if you wanted to try, I want you to know that, you know, we're here, we're on the phone, you can come in, you can weigh your baby, you know, we'll really give you all the support that your sister probably didn't get.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep, I think that's a reasonable approach. We have two callers. Let's try to take these calls. First is Catherine. Catherine, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say that I was aware that breastfeeding was really beneficial. It was a good thing to do. and I have the teeniest, tiniest breasts in the world. And I didn't know if I would be able to do it. And my son was a couple of weeks premature, and they brought him in a couple of hours after the birth and said, oh, he's hungry. And he was, and he just latched right on. And so I just think a positive attitude is all you need.
You know, there's a couple of messages there I think maybe worth commenting on. Let's ask Dr. Cadwell her comments.
Well, one is that the baby doesn't know from big breasts or small breasts. So, and the attraction of the baby is to the smell of your Montgomery glands. You know, the little bumps on the areola that are really very, very special and produce a special fluid that actually smells and tastes like amniotic fluid. So when and smell really is the most important sense to babies. So when the baby got close to you and he smelled that familiar smell that, you know, and tastes that familiar taste, it's not really about the size or the shape of the breast. It's really about coming home, and that's what happens when a baby gets close to the breast.
You'd made a comment, Catherine, that it was a couple of hours before they brought the baby. That caught my attention since Dr. Cadwell had mentioned that the early introduction is important, but then I remembered that you said your son was premature, so there may have been a little bit of a initial delay because of that.
Yeah, maybe, but, you know, he was 7 pounds, 3 ounces. Oh, my goodness. And I'm really glad that he was a little bit premature. And, man, I mean, he was born to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
wonderful.
You know, they brought him in, and when they brought him into the room at Providence Hospital, his lips were making a sucking sound, even like 12 feet away from me. So, you know, he was born to eat, and I knew that breastfeeding was the right thing to do, and it wasn't a real simple thing to do in the beginning, but it worked out, and I breastfed him for almost a year.
And so women with smaller breasts do not need to worry that's going to be a problem, it sounds like.
Nope.
Okay. No. Thanks for your comments, Catherine.
Okay. Thank you. And research bears that up, that the size of the woman's breasts have nothing to do with her ability to meet her personal goals for breastfeeding. But a new Danish study indicates that healthcare providers are very prejudiced, at least in Denmark, about looking at the size of the woman's breasts and determining whether or not she'll be able to meet her goals for breastfeeding.
Okay.
So with us, we have to watch out for that.
All right, let's take another caller. Phyllis, you're on line one.
Hi, my name's Stella.
Oh, okay. Pardon me.
I had a question about you know, the toxin buildups, you hear about it, and it's found in, like, blubber and mammal fat and stuff, and it's been, I've read stories, I mean, about it being found in breast milk in animals and in human beings, and I was wondering if Karen had read anything on that as far as formula being better in that case. You know, especially if a mother's older, like in her mid-30s and on, that lifetime of accumulation and then, you know, coming out the breast, going to her child.
So in the sense, this is a related question to the safety of breast milk because of potential exposure to toxins. We've heard a lot about lead and mercury and fish and other
exactly.
ways of getting it. So how does that square with safety issues between breast and formula?
Well, I think this is a legitimate concern. And, you know, all around the world, scientists use breast milk as the marker for how polluted our world is. And so we see the headlines that say, you know, breast milk is found to have mercury, or breast milk is found to have lead or dioxin or, you know, other toxins. And what we have to recognize is that breast milk just happens to have fat in it, and it's an easily obtainable substance that you can get all over the world. And excuse me, and it is the marker for how polluted our world is. There are some cases where there have been industrial spills. There was the case of PCBs in Michigan where women were drinking cow's milk that was laden with chemicals from fire retardant. Some bales of fire retardant got mixed up with bales of cow feed, and cows ate the fire retardant. I guess, you know, they don't have a lot of taste, I guess. and the women on the farms who were breastfeeding and drinking their own cow's milk had very high levels of these in their milk. This was in Michigan during the Nixon administration. So it was quite a while ago. But they had an opportunity to study, and what they realized was that what women put in their milk is very, very little compared to the toxins that pass to the baby during pregnancy. So it's during pregnancy that babies are really given the toxins that we've accumulated in our lifetime. Breast milk conveys actually very, very little toxin compared to pregnancy.
Wow. Okay, good. Well, thank you for answering my question.
All right. Thanks for your question, Phyllis.
All right. Bye.
And I should mention that I do believe I'm correct in saying I know that the state of Alaska has looked at the amount of, I'm going to say, mercury, it may be lead in the fish, and that there has not been an issue here in Alaska associated with increased exposure of women who may be pregnant or in their milk. So hopefully I'm being exactly right. If an epidemiologist for the state is listening, I will appreciate their call to make sure I'm saying that exactly right. I'm going to have to take a short break here. We do that every program. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and discuss further on breastfeeding with Dr. Karen Cadwell. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage, Alaska on KSKA. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Karen Cadwell, an internationally recognized leader on breastfeeding and human lactation. If you've got questions or comments during the next 30 minutes or so, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that at any time between 7 and 8 that you might be listening, you're listening to a rebroadcast and we won't be able to answer your questions. Dr. Cadwell, we've got another caller. I want to take her call first. Mary Lynn, you're on line one.
Hi, yes. I was wondering why, if breastfeeding helps decrease your risk factors of breast cancer, that that's not included in more trainings and that are given to women about decreasing risk factors with breast cancer.
All right.
I think it's the silo effect. The breast cancer people talk to breast cancer people. The breastfeeding people talk to breastfeeding people. You know, and we don't get a really good chance to talk to each other. But I think that there's been some seepage over the side into breastfeeding people, getting the message to breast cancer people that they need to pay attention to the breastfeeding literature and the reproductive health literature. And I'm hoping that as we move forward in the future that we're going to have more interest. For example, in the breast cancer literature, when it talks about things that you can do, it will often say things like, you know, drink less alcohol and eat fewer fried potatoes, but rarely mentions breastfeeding. Part of that is, I think, is lack of information, and part of it is just the touchiness of not wanting to make people feel guilty for not breastfeeding if they now have breast cancer, or not breastfeeding enough if they have breast cancer. So it's really hard to talk about breastfeeding and not evoke a lot of emotions and guilt in a group of women.
What's the mechanism by which breastfeeding might be protective?
Well, I think that there are several theories about that. One is the fact that breastfeeding women don't resume their periods as quickly. And I think many reproductive researchers think it's that unrelenting menstrual cycles that lead to reproductive cancers. And that when you look at the history of women, breast cancer used to be called the nun's disease. It was noted even as far back as the 12th and 13th century that women who lived in convents were much more likely to get breast cancer than women who lived out in the community, who probably were either pregnant or nursing for, you know, their whole fertile years, for all of their fertile years. And that's pretty much held true. You know, it's the number of months that you menstruate without having relief of pregnancy and lactation that seems to be correlated in terms of reproduction with getting breast cancer.
Okay.
Now, I mean, there are lots of other reasons. There's family reasons and, you know, genetic reasons too.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, the larger population, that's probably a big piece of it.
We had an email that's a little bit at the other end of this kind of questioning, but the listener would like to know why her breasts continue to produce milk more than a year after stopping breastfeeding. She noticed the first thing happened with her first child, and it took a year and a half to stop. Yeah. And how can she cause the breast milk to stop being produced?
It's not going to. It's because breastfeeding is the default. So once your breasts sort of get into lactation, they're like, okay, we know how to do this, and that's the default. It really takes a long time to sort of, using computer terms, reset your breasts to not lactating. And it's such a protective mechanism to, you know, to keep the cells working like that. And we know, for example, that postmenopausal women can relactate for their grandchildren. Because once your milk cells have been turned on, they're really turned on pretty much forever. She may stop noticing milk after a year and a half, but those cells have been ripened. They're ready. And so, you know, the milk may not be coming out anymore, but the cells are still ready to make milk.
Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned previously that not all women may actually be able to produce, perhaps for some specific reason, with receptors for the hormone prolactin. What about breastfeeding for twins? Is if a woman can feed one twin, has it been your experience that they usually should be able to produce enough milk for to feed twins? Now, I understand there's always exceptions, but in general, is that true?
Well, I'll tell you, there's supposedly a law still in the books in West Virginia that you can't nurse more than seven babies. So obviously,
okay.
The observation was that, you know, certainly you should be able to make milk for two. And when we look to other mammals, you know, who might have twins,
right.
They can always make milk for the number of babies that they have. When we're looking at the particular issues with twins, we know, for example, that twins born prematurely are less likely to be successful than twins who are born close to term. So that's a confounding variable in the whole twin breastfeeding piece. So
mm-hmm.
if the mother has premature twins, they're likely to be separated, especially in those first hours. People are worried about how they're doing, so nobody's paying attention to her breasts and getting her started. So her prolactin receptor sites are in trouble. And then people tend to think, well, she can feed one baby and then feed the other baby, when we know that simultaneous stimulation gives you three times the prolactin level, not twice the prolactin level. So you get sort of a geometric rather than an arithmetic increase in your hormonal response if both babies go on at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you're struggling with prematurity, you're struggling with hospital routines, and struggling with sort of the idea of protecting the mother from having both babies on the breast at the same time.
All right. Myra, you're on line one. Can we answer your question?
Yeah, I had a question about mastitis. With my first baby, I had mastitis really bad to the point I could barely function. And I'm due with my second baby in about 5 weeks, and I'm nervous about having such bad mastitis again. And I was wondering if there's any way what I can do to avoid that or...
Mm-hmm. When you answer this question, would you mind for me distinguishing between the symptoms of mastitis and the symptoms of a blocked duct?
Well, a blocked duct is a lump in the breast that can move or disappear within 24 or 48 hours. Mm-hmm. It's a local problem where some of the water has come out of the milk and the milk is really thick, mm-hmm. and doesn't move as easily through the delivery system of the ducts in the breast.
Can it cause pain and fever or redness?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It's only local.
Okay.
With mastitis, you get a systemic effect. So the mother feels like she's been run over by a truck, and our caller, was it Mara?
Myra.
You know, really describes how horrible it is that you really can't function. It comes on very, very suddenly. So you're, you know, just doing a chore around the house, and suddenly you may not be able to even think about how you're going to get to bed. Women have told me that they've ended up crawling into bed because they you know, couldn't move their body any other way. It's a horrible and very, very sudden experience for most women. What happens with mastitis is that the milk escapes from the milk system into the tissues of the breast. And as a result, the body responds with a, you know, huge response, sending all these white blood cells, you know, raising the temperature so that if there is an infective organism there, it can kill it, because that's what our bodies do. We raise our temperature in order to kill organisms that can't exist at those higher temperatures. And it's really just a terrible, terrible experience. So the idea is to not get milk outside of the milk system. And that involves, you know, not putting pressure on the breast. Sometimes it's car seat belts. It can be a wrinkled nightie that's pressing into the breast on one side, tight bras, putting things inside of the bra, plastic things inside of the bra to, you know, protect the nipples or whatever people think those plastic things are meant to do. So it's putting that pressure, back pressure, onto the breast that pushes the milk out into the breast tissue. So it can be infective, but probably 95% of the time it's non-infective. And the solution is anti-inflammatories, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like Motrin or Advil, something like that, is the best thing to do on the outset to try to stop the inflammatory response. Now, in terms of why some women might be more prone to it, anemic women are much more likely to get mastitis. So one thing that you could do is be sure that you're not anemic. The second thing would be to take care of your breasts, keep them soft, and watch out for pressure on your breasts. Just because you had it one time with one baby does not mean you'll get it another time.
Okay. Okay, so there's nothing like right away I should do as soon as the delivery or whatever to...
What about preparing her breasts before the delivery?
Oh, no.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, the research is really clear that the best preparation is mental preparation.
Okay. All right.
But in terms of, you know, what happens is a woman who's had mastitis knows that she needs to not let milk build up in her breast. So what women often do is they think, oh, I know, I'll just keep pumping my breasts to keep the milk from building up. And actually that gives the breast the message, make milk, make more milk, make more milk. And you have women who have enough milk for two or three or four babies. And then if you just postpone pumping for a half hour, you can end up with mastitis. So don't make your breasts make more milk than they need for your baby. And if you want to collect milk, wait until a little bit, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks afterwards before you start collecting it, so you don't give your body a false sense of how much milk to make.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you. It's very helpful.
Thanks for your call. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Debbie, you're on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Debbie. What can we do for you?
Well, I work for the state of Alaska. I'm a perinatal nurse consultant in the section of Women's, Children's, and Family Health. And I was calling to respond to the issue that came up about fish facts related to consumption of Alaska fish. And the recommendations that came out that you referred to did talk about mercury. And I wanted to give a website in case folks were interested in getting more information.
Good.
It is epi.alaska.gov/EH/fish.
Okay.
And there is a fish calculator there at the top that a person could click on that actually gives assigns points to certain kinds of fish for pregnant women and recommends a certain number of points per week, I think it is. And many of the fish in Alaska are 0 points, and a woman can eat as many servings as those fish safely as she wants to when she's pregnant or breastfeeding. And then there's other fish listed that, you know, require some sort of a limit because they tend to have mercury.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's what we needed.
Okay, good. I have one question, too, I would like to ask. I want to thank you both for a really interesting show. And I wanted to ask Dr. Caldwell about her feelings on bed sharing around breastfeeding.
Oh, well, as you probably know, there's a lot of controversy about bed sharing, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that babies should sleep in close proximity to their mothers, and whether that's next to them or in bed with them is kind of a muted point when they say in close proximity. One thing that we know from studies in England is that most parents are going to take their baby into bed with them at some time. And if that's the case in the United States, and we have no reason to think that it isn't, then we have to ask the question, how can we make it safe? One problem that researchers have found is that when parents are told, don't take your baby into bed with you, they sleep with their baby on the couch, or they sleep with their baby in a recliner. And those are two really, really dangerous places to sleep with babies. The other thing that parents may do, according to research, is put the baby in bed with somebody else because they think that they're not supposed to sleep with their baby. So they'll put the baby, you know, comfort the baby by putting them in with grandma or Aunt Agnes or someone else who actually may be taking medications, sleep medications, et cetera, and be really an unsafe bed companion for a baby. Mm-hmm. So the question comes down to, if parents are going to do this, how can we help them to do it most safely? And telling them not to do it doesn't seem to work because people do take their babies into bed with them. So it's really a tension on the public health sector on how we can protect babies from unsafe sleeping conditions and at the same time promote breastfeeding, because we know that babies who sleep near their mothers take in about 37% more milk at night than babies who don't sleep near their mothers. Hmm. So Helen Ball is a researcher in England who's probably the primary researcher on whether or not babies should how babies should be treated in the hospital or birthing center with their parents. And James McKenna is the researcher in the United States who really looks at babies at home with their mothers and what their sleep conditions are like. What they find is that for breastfeeding mothers, when they sleep with their babies, 100% of them sleep in the same position, which is the mother curls around the baby and supports herself with her outside arm in a way that's almost impossible for her to overlie the baby. That's not true with other people, other adults. Even other adults who are used to sleeping with babies don't tend to sleep in the same way. But it still is a scary scenario to have babies in bed if there are unsafe conditions. Parents who smoke, for example, it's unsafe. People who have lots of bedding, fluffy bedding, things like that, unsafe beds, they just make a very, very scary scenario for a little baby.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Debbie.
I don't know where we're going to go with bed sharing, honestly.
Yeah, I think this is an important issue.
Hard.
Yeah, I had an epidemiologist with the state health department here who has looked into it, issues in Alaska, and investigated scenes, and there has never been a case in Alaska where it was felt to be that there was a bad outcome with infants in bed with mothers if the mother or another cohabiting person was of reasonable condition. They weren't drunk.
Right.
They weren't. And so I think this needs to be ferreted out more. I think many, many pediatricians have their kids in bed with them, and I'm one of them. And so I think this is this needs to be clarified, as I think what you're saying.
Yeah, and we can't figure it out unless we get good research data.
Right.
And it takes somebody like the epidemiologist that you're describing, who's really looking into the case, to help us to understand it better. We know, for example, that people in China, Japan, et cetera, sleep with their babies all the time and don't have problems with SIDS or cot death, you know, during the night deaths. Part of that is that they sleep on very, very firm beds. They don't have a lot of blankets. It's hot. And mothers don't generally, or haven't in the past anyway, smoked or taken drugs or used alcohol. So those kinds of things can make a big difference.
We are into our last 5 minutes. I have a couple of emails and a phone call. I'm not sure we're going to get to all of them, so I apologize ahead of time if we do not get to your call. But I want to take this email in particular because it raises some questions we haven't discussed. This is an email I have from a mother of a two-month-old who is wholly breastfed, hearing from other mothers ahead of time that it may be easier or natural. Allowed me to get not too discouraged when I had trouble. My questions, why or how do breastfeeding herbs such as fenugreek work? And once milk production is increased, how long do these herbs take to work? She's got another question, but let's talk about fenugreek. I would like you to mention also acupuncture, which I'm seeing recommended also now. What do we know about the success and mechanism of these ideas for increasing breast milk?
Well, unfortunately, most of these things don't work at all. And when researchers have studied galactagogues, they find that in randomized control trials, for example, when women are given something that they tell them is going to help their milk supply versus, you know, one of these so-called galactagogues or milk-enhancing herbs or drugs, there really isn't any difference. Even with drugs like Reglan, which is, a prescription drug that they could be given, mothers might have more higher prolactin levels, but they don't necessarily make more milk. And an individual woman's experience, I went to see somebody and told her I didn't have enough milk, and they gave me an herb, and then I had more milk. Well, it could have been the fact that she told you something else when you were with her, or that she increased your confidence, or that as a result of the visit, you nursed one more time a day. And those kinds of things are often not taken into consideration. People give all of the credit to the herb, The problem with fenugreek is that it interferes with all other drugs taken orally. So any oral drug that the mother is taking is not going to be as effective. And I can tell you about a mother that I saw who was taking fenugreek who had low thyroid. And she was on Synthroid, but her thyroid levels hadn't been checked after she had a baby. And she had a low milk supply, so somebody recommended fenugreek. And her milk supply didn't go up, so she took more fenugreek. And her milk supply didn't go up, so she took more fenugreek. And the problem was actually that her Synthroid was now not functioning because of the amount of fenugreek she was taking. The solution was to stop taking fenugreek, get her thyroid levels checked, and actually increase the amount of Synthroid that she was taking, and then her milk supply was huge. She had plenty of milk. So not only are they, questionable in their success, but they can interfere with other things. I've seen mothers, for example, with high blood pressure on high blood pressure medications taking fenugreek, whose blood pressure drugs had been increased and increased and increased until they came off of the fenugreek.
We have just about a minute left. One last question. What's the optimum length of time that you would recommend or that we have evidence for the length of time breastfeeding should continue? One of our listeners says she's read that 18 months to 2 years may be necessary for brain and eye development, for example.
Well, we know that the longer breastfeeding goes on, the more and different benefits there are. We know, for example, that breastfeeding in the second half of the first year is probably what makes the biggest difference in IQ. The World Health Organization recommends 2 to 3 years of breastfeeding, or as long as the mother and baby choose. The American Academy of Pediatrics in the U.S. has said 1 year or longer as the mother and baby choose to. Women who have breastfed older babies past a year will tell you that it's really not like breastfeeding a newborn baby. It's an entirely different experience. And women who have breastfed toddlers would say, I can't imagine having a toddler that I wasn't breastfeeding because it's just such a wonderful experience.
Any final comments? Any things you want to leave with our listeners?
Well, of course, thousands of things to say. But you asked about acupuncture, and I think we didn't really talk about that. And that is that I think that Chinese medicine and different ideas from around the world can have merit, but they have to be studied in a randomized way. And the problem with acupuncture or acupressure is the same as with any of the ideas about increasing milk supply, is that you really need a huge sample and dealing with a lot of confounding variables before you can figure it out.
Dr. Cadwell, thanks very much for taking the time to join us on Line One.
I was so happy to do it. Thank you.
All right. For our listeners, if you want to continue with today's conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find the links on our new website, alaskapublic.org. We're going to be gone next week, but in 2 weeks we'll be back and we'll be talking with Jenny Gupp. She's the owner of Alaska Fit Boot Camps and co-author of three steps to your best body in record time. We're going to be talking about how to get in shape at any time and at any age. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Dave Waldron stepped in today to help. Thanks for listening, especially those of you who called and emailed.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.